Welcome to our 22nd symposia. It's, of course, fantastic to see everybody here, particularly our guest presenter. Would you please stand? That's Brian Fredrickson, thank you, and his wife, Michelle. I just want you to know that this is like the biggest one we've ever had, even for the traveling to Greece, so I hope you're honored, and we're all excited to hear all kinds of stories. Go ahead, I'm going to talk a little bit. I just wanted everybody to see you and make sure you could get out. It's wonderful to see everybody here tonight, and I'm sorry we had that little snafu at the beginning. We're working on trying to make the exit a little bit easier so when the final dish is served, you all able to leave instead of me saying, well, that person has the glasses and that person has the stripe, and trying to explain how to pay at the end of the night. So it was something we tried new. And anyways, we're going to start tonight. This is the Drenched with Honey symposia. And that means that I set myself a challenge every time I do a symposia, and this one is to include honey as an ingredient in every item. So last night I was here till 1 o'clock writing up all my menus, and that was fun. And I woke up, with a sore throat, but I woke up ready to go and excited to do this. So this is something that we put on. So this is how I prefer to cook, by the way. It's something that's spot on and to the point, fresh, ordered, and of course, because I order to the dinner, sometimes things don't show up, and even though we plan months and months ahead in some cases, so there's always a variation. Tonight, you came, and we had Yigindis. Now, Yigindis are on the regular menu, but Yigindis are versatile bean, and they're only from Greece, and they were boiled, and then they were baked with olive oil, and we did a little fresh red sauce with cilantro, and some celery feathers, and a little red cabbage and shallots squeezed and dressed in salt. So there was a little bit of salt, a little bit, but the beans were cooked with honey and a dash of vinegar. So something a little bit different, and I hope you enjoyed that. The green olives, that's always a trick to do olives with honey. So we did it with lavender and shallots again. There'll be some themes, and green pepper. I hope you enjoyed that. And then we have bobota. Now, bobota is what we call in America cornbread. And when you talk to an elder Greek person, and I'm not going to include my husband in that one, they will tell you that it was so bad during World War II that we had to eat cornbread. So cornbread was considered a very low peasant food. I looked up some recipes online, and I do have one that was completely gluten-free. And if anybody wants to try that, it's very crumbly. But it's also vegan, if I remember correctly. So we had that with... So we started out with a little bobota because I wanted you to try something a little bit different and get your tummies full. The only thing you'll not find honey in tonight is butter, honey butter, okay? There's no honey butter tonight, so drop those expectations, please. We paired it with ninimos, which is a blend of Chardonnay and Rhodites from the winery of Lafkioti in northern Peloponnesos. We go to there. We're friends with Yana, and our daughter worked at this winery. We love their wines, and we love to promote them. I will be going back now to prepare the second course, which is quote-unquote the salad or the secundi, and that will be grilled halloumi cheese, and that was part of the problem tonight. We did not, I opened up the case, and it was half a case of what I expected, so we had to run out and get some halloumi cheese, but in fact, they didn't have it either, so... we have a little halloumi cheese and cavolo graviera. So the cavolo graviera cheese is going to be a little bit more salty. It has been grilled on an infrared grill with and fire finished. And we have prepared some kalimirna and mission figs in a balsamic vinegar sauce that's going to go with that. So that, and then the bread that I make every symposia now is becoming kind of a mainstay. And it's from my own... it's now 3 months old, so you can tell me if you've been here before how the sponge has changed. It's my own sourdough starter, and that, of course, has honey because keeping with the subject, we put honey in everything. So, and that we're going to do with mead. Now, mead, you may or may not know, is the oldest form of organized fermented beverage. We think that it was basically when honey in the honey producers started in northern Africa, and when they were trying to save every bit of sweetness, they would rinse the honeycomb. And if it sat around a little bit too long, it would get fermented. And they kind of like that, apparently. So our mead is from Colorado. It has won more Bravos and awards than any other mead in the United States. And we'll revisit the same meadery, which is called Redstone, as a dessert wine, which is completely different than what you'll be having with your second course. So at this time, I'd like to turn the mic over to Brian, and please give him a round of applause.
Thank you, Anna. You're making me hungry with such a great description of that menu. I got my start in bees sort of by accident in 94. I purchased an orchard out in the Watertown, Minnesota area. It was actually an orchard that the horticulturist that created the Honeycrisp apple planted, his original orchard, and a couple of beehives came with it. And boom, I was a reluctant beekeeper. And probably like most people, I had some level of fear and respect for the bees. And slowly I made mistakes. I made a few correct moves, and I became a beekeeper. And as time has gone on, that's become sort of the main part of our business. We still grow apples. We manage 2,000 apple trees. We're running about 450 beehives, but it's a few beehives. It's been a stepwise, though, growth the whole time, starting with the original 800 tree orchard and the two hives. I worked full time at the beginning at 3M Company, and built the business through the farmers market, where I've really met Ebert and Avart, sorry. Many long-term customers that have created business for us and the co-ops and so on. And anyhow, tonight I want to talk about how the interaction between bees and the environment, how things are changing fairly fast. Land use types of changes, the way farming has changed, just the way people sort of view land nowadays from 50 years ago, and the impact of dairy, for example, on beekeeping, and different interests now in food also is driving some changes in beekeeping. We'll talk a little bit about the differences in honey, the different flavors, you know, the different plants and so on, how a particular plant that grows in one part of Minnesota produces honey can taste different somewhere else. There's a lot of interesting things going on in beekeeping right now. I mean, the explosion of interest is really on the hobby, sort of backyard beekeeping, beekeeper right now. But what really is at the center of most of the bee problems is a mite that moved into what happened is it jumped host from an Asian honeybee to the European honeybee and started spreading from Europe and over here to North America. It's now on every continent except Australia. Even Hawaii has the mites up there. And it's if I was a honeybee and I had a mite on me, just the scale of it, you would be, you know, in awe. Like, how was I still alive and still had this parasite? So you hear a lot of different things, you know, about the bee crisis, especially back in 07, and there's a lot of different agendas behind sometimes people's story or what they believe in is causing honeybee declines, but I assure you these mites are at the center of all of it. Before the mites came, basically many farmers and rural people could put a hive of bees out in the back 40. You could leave them go, and they could continue going for a long time. If they didn't swarm out, if they had enough food for the winter, beekeeping was a bit more simple. But with these mites now, a successful beekeeper is not just understanding the life cycle of the honeybee, he's managing mites. You got to manage sort of the concentrations of these mites are always going to be there. You're never going to eradicate them. So you raise bees in different ways. You look for strains of bees that have natural resistance to these mites, and it's just totally changed the whole business. And we'll talk about industrial beekeeping. Right now, 1.5 million hives or so are in California to pollinate an Asian nut tree, the almond, blooming in the middle of winter in North America. You know what my bees are doing in the middle of winter? Nothing, you know? They're hanging out where they should be in a rest cycle and consuming stored honey and pollen. These feedlot bees in California, in order to get them to be populated and pollinate these huge monocrop orchards, they're going to feed them a corn syrup, soy flour mix to imitate nectar and pollen coming in. They need to get these bees to raise, you know, more bees at a time of the year when they normally don't. So why would we be surprised? You know, you got feedlot dairy, pork, poultry. We got feedlot beekeeping out there too. And, you know, there's a huge market in almonds. It's one of the biggest cash crops in North America. A lot of it's exported to Asia. It's a huge industry, but that's a part of the bee business that affects me even here, because the spread of disease when you have that many colonies in one place, it's not a natural environment for the honeybee. So in many ways, I like a challenge, and beekeeping is a challenge, just to keep bees alive, get them through the winter, not use chemicals or expose them to some of these heavy industrial sort of practices. It has really gotten to be an art, and to get them to produce honey on top of it. It's a very interesting and challenging pastime or business in my case. So I guess I haven't been to one of these events, but the main meal will be coming out, and then I'm going to come back and do a formal talk. And near the end, there'll be question and answers. We have some product here. I have my queen bee here, Michelle. She knows a lot about our products, of course, and the business. So we'll be mingling here at the end, where you can come and ask me some additional questions or taste some of our honey. We'll have some samples over here later, and you know, have some fun and get to know each other a little bit. So.
And you know, when you're putting together a menu that everything has honey as an ingredient, you're thinking about like what really works with honey and what doesn't. So you won't find some things in the menu tonight, but you will find fish, because we are going to bring you out some wild caught cod and haddock haddock and salmon, and we're going to dress it with a little shallot and vinegar and honey dress relish on top. And then we're going to proceed, and I think you're just going to be happy with the mead and the ninimos at that point with the fish. But then we're going to proceed to the honey glazed lamb riblets on a hash of kabocha squash. So, you know, as I was saying, the kabocha squash is one that just really tore me apart this time, because I ordered butternut squash. And when it came, they tried to convince me that it's the same thing, and I'm like... So we went into the computer and we pulled up, is kabocha squash buttercup squash, butternut squash? And oh no, indeed it's not. But it did say it was sweeter and held its flavor better, which I found completely not true after I cut it and accepted it and cut it and roasted it. And I opened it up and it was like, this is not what I wanted. But kombucha, for all those people who don't know, is round, okay? And the butternut cup is squash. It's a flattened, cylindric, dark green. Kabocha is a rounded, and perhaps if it was ripe or made in another country where there's a sun or something like that, it would be tasty, but this was not so tasty. So unfortunately, I had to do a little preparation, and it's called a bit of mead, a bit of rosemary, lots of honey, lots of fennel and garlic, and hopefully we'll all enjoy it. But it's going to be on the base of your lamb riblets. So, and I really wanted to do that with a Certified Evil. We have taps now. Certified Evil is a crossover beverage. It has almost as much alcohol as wine. And the mead, by the way, does, so don't kid yourself. I didn't know if I mentioned that to you. Mead has 11% alcohol. And the Certified Evil is fermented 6 months in Cabernet barrels, so it's considered a crossover beverage. We will revisit Certified Evil again. We've had it already once in our meal, and I won't tell you where, but it's going to come back again at the end. So Certified Evil is a dark chocolatey coffee kind of a beer, and I think it's going to be fantastic with the lamb. Now, if anybody wants a nice red wine, I can certainly recommend that. Just raise your hand when we come around, and we'll take care of that. No problem, okay? Now, this is our long and lengthy time with Brian, and so I'm going to ask him to come up and make his presentation. And he's got some wonderful, wonderful products here he brought. And we're going to do some honey tasting. So, you know, save your palate for later.
Right. So tell him that. I should have said that.
Okay. I'm curious. How many beekeepers do we have here tonight? Beekeepers? Couple? Good.
Wannabe
beekeepers?
Yeah.
All right. Good. For those considering it, the U of M here has one of the world's leading bee researchers, Marla Spivak, and they have a beginner's course. It's the first weekend in March, and highly recommend that, by the way. So a little bit of background about bees, since we don't have quite as many beekeepers as I thought might show up tonight.
Future.
Contemplating, maybe. The European honeybee was brought over by immigrants in the 1600s. We didn't have honeybees in North and South America. We do have 300 or 400 other native pollinators that generally fly in a very short distance, like across the farm or something like that. Most of those don't make any sort of crop. So European honeybees are, in a way, an invasive species. And it's really no surprise that a lot of the plants that they like are plants that came from Europe. Dandelions, clover, alfalfa, purple loosestrife, which is a wetland, one that's moving around. We do have some native plants here like basswood or linden tree, which is one of my favorite honeys. I have some of it here tonight to taste. That goes back to really the beginning of time and beekeeping. You know, what other sort of food-based activity can you think of that has such a long history as bees and beekeeping, you know, that has roots in all the early ancient cultures, people collecting honey, or I mean, how basic just to stick your finger in that comb and taste it, you know, as food has changed throughout time, honey is still that basic, wow, that's just awesome, you know, and how can they do that with just flowers and this little insect? And really, what almost every culture has honey, except for the Inuit, which were formerly known as Eskimos in the far north. Every culture has some sort of honey and beekeeping. So here in the United States, you know, it got started with immigrants that came with honeybees from Europe. We have a couple different species, I wouldn't say they're not species, but strains of honeybees, like the Italian honeybee that originates in the Mediterranean part of Europe, and it's more of a warm weather bee. It's the most common honeybee that you might keep or purchase. They use a lot of them for the almond pollinating that I talked about earlier. The Carniolan, though, honeybee is of more interest to me because I'm, you know, we're in a northern climate here, and those originated in parts of the Ukraine and Russia, where the climate is similar to here. So honeybees are living on a cycle, kind of like a squirrel or a bear that you think of that, you know, is going to collect some food to get through the winter. I mean, really, that's what we did before we came so sophisticated. Now we don't really live on that cycle of collecting food for the winter. But that's their goal. They're going to raise a huge population of honeybees in the spring into about a month after the solstice in July, and then the population's going to decrease. And that boom of population is when you can collect huge amounts of honey. 2010 and 11 were some of the worst seasons I ever saw here. We got 30 or 40 pounds of honey per hive. Last year, we had close to 120 pounds per hive. So when things are clicking, we had an early spring, the populations were big, you can make a tremendous amount of honey. And where beekeepers come into this is we can do things to assist the bees. The goal is to raise a lot of honeybees in the spring and then get them into and through the winter. But so back to sort of this life cycle of honeybees, you have workers that are unfertilized females. I mean, guess what? The women do all the useful work. The drones, the males, what do you think they're there for, right? You know, a little bit of fun, a little bit of action. They contribute nothing. They eat food. You know, they don't make any food. But, you know, in October, when they're not needed, they're there for mating, you know. They get shoved out on a cold October morning, so it's, you know, they get what they got coming. So, queen bees are very interesting. While a worker bee only lives about 6 weeks at the peak of the season, they basically wear themselves out from collecting so much honey and working. Queens can live 2 or 3 years. And when they're born, they fly a couple of times and get mated up to 30 sometimes. And that will carry them through their productive life. And they can lay up to a couple thousand eggs a day. And when the conditions are right, when enough food is coming in the hive, like in April and May, this is when they can really start laying a lot of eggs. And what's happening then is the number of bees that are hatching out is more than the number that are dying. So you get this big spike of population. And at this time of the year, the bees quit laying eggs back in November. They went through a broodless period. We're now away, way beyond the solstice that happened in December. And now they are laying eggs again, and they're starting to raise new honeybees for this coming season. So even in these cold days, it's amazing. You know, I always say, if you don't believe in a higher power or something, some spiritual things, keep some honeybees for a while. I mean, that they could raise or lay eggs and raise honeybees in this time of the year on these temperatures like we've had this week is really amazing. So what's happening then is they'll hopefully make a honey crop, build up enough excess food to get through the winter, and this is where beekeepers come in again, too. We'll take off a honey crop a couple times during the year, and when we get into the fall, we'll just stop collecting honey and let them store that for the winter. I was talking a little earlier about the mites and how this has totally changed how beekeepers think and act. Mites are parasites, so they need a host to reproduce on. And the larger, more productive hives will have more mites in. So like last year, we had one of our better honey seasons. We had more mite problems than in the fall. We had a lot of honeybees. They can be killed with chemicals, and that's really what happened here in the 1990s. The mites came over from Europe. Any hive of bees that you look at here in the United States will have some mites, and they started putting insecticide strips, you know, poisons in beehives to kill these mites. And it did work initially. But honeycombs that are made out of wax, I have some along here tonight that are edible. Honeycomb, the wax itself was designed by nature to absorb natural toxins and just get rid of things in the hive. So what that means is things are absorbed very easily in the beeswax. So these chemicals that these well-meaning beekeepers were putting into their hives in the 90s were absorbed into these combs. And these combs that hang in the hives you can use for 20, 30 years. So they basically self-contaminated their hives in the late 90s, mid-90s or so, and created a lot of problems where two of these chemicals impact the reproductive ability of queens, the level of how sterile the male bees are, and really set the stage for a lot of problems. On top of that, these mites weaken the bees and make them more susceptible to viruses that naturally occurred in nature. So what you have is a population of mites that's going to increase to a point where it'll cause the hive to collapse in the fall or the winter. And you really need to have some sort of plan. I mean, like organic farming, for example, isn't like, well, we're just not going to use any chemicals and just plant. You plant certain types of crops in a system that will mitigate the pest or disease problems that you know are an issue with trying to raise a crop. So we went through this gyration of putting these horrible chemicals in hives, and as we got into, I would say, 2000 or so, 2001, people started realizing that they could use things like thymol, which is a naturally occurring material. You find it in oregano and a few other plants. Oxalic acid, found in rhubarb. I believe it's also even found in honey. Formic acid also. Those are sort of the three natural types of materials that you can use to put in hives to cut these mites back. And as time has gone on, bee researchers have found some bees that can physically defend themselves from these mites and have a resistance. And in fact, they found in parts of Russia some European honeybees that were exposed to these mites for several hundred years, and they brought them here to the United States. We're one of about three dozen apiaries that have these genetics. They're called Russian honeybees. They're really Carniolan honeybees, the northern strain I talked about before. So we have these softer natural chemical approaches now, and we also have bees that have some sort of natural survival instincts. So these are some of the things that we're doing and other progressive beekeepers are doing to sort of get ahead of these mites. I mean, we're living now not in these pristine sort of environments like in Europe 50 or 100 years ago, where they had regional differences in honeybees and things were more stable. A honeybee can hop a ride on an airplane and fly across the world in a half a day and spread a disease or something now. So we're in a much more different environment. And as time has gone on, I mean, we all know about sort of the farm bill, the way that our government subsidizes the planting of corn and soybeans. A lot of it is not really destined for food. It's for ethanol or to feed livestock, for example. And these policies are driven by lobbyists and large corporations that benefit from buying corn syrup or corn at a very low price to use as an ingredient. But they're very detrimental to honeybees. There's incentives now for people to plant corn in land that really isn't very productive. They get a subsidy or a benefit from the government for doing it. But honeybees depend on a very diverse food source like ourselves. I mean, you wouldn't want to just live on rice or cornbread or something like that. You want to have vegetables, an array of minerals and vitamins. And this is getting to be an issue here now in the United States. If you get outside of the Twin Cities, you see these massive, you know, plantings of corn and soybeans, and we don't have near the sort of idle land that we used to. Up until the 1960s, a dairy farmer would graze their dairy cattle on clover, for example. All that's gone now. Most of the dairy cattle are fed corn, and they're kept in a feedlot. They don't even go out on pasture. So these have been dramatic changes, you know, sort of in the types of plants that are available to honeybees. For us at Ames Farm, we focus more actually right around the Twin Cities. We have a lot of hives that are sort of on that fringe area where it's not heavy agriculture. There's set aside pieces of land that are parks or other conservation areas or river bottoms. So that's sort of an issue that, you know, everyone can contribute to in some way. I mean, if you own some acreage, can you, you know, leave some land, develop your land to have wild plants and things that are flowering late in the season instead of mowing things down and having more of a planted type landscape. Honeybees need, you know, just a wide diversity of pollen and food that's coming in. And a lot of these agricultural areas just don't have that. You'll have a massive field of alfalfa or some ditches that have clover in. They just don't have any diversity. The rest of the, you know, 85-90% of the land area is corn, crops like that that don't offer anything to honeybees. So, you know, you hear a lot in the news, the honeybees are dying, you know, there's all these issues. And is it true? Well, yes. I mean, it is true. We've lost a lot of this habitat. We have bees that are sort of propped up, being kept alive through chemical uses like that. So it's a fragile kind of situation, if you will, in a way that humans' interaction with the honeybees is not. We don't have any policy, I guess is what I'm trying to say, to make sure that land uses in the future are going to consider the pollinator. We consider so many other types of wildlife, things like predator birds, you know, eagles and things like that. We have policies in place for fish and water quality and things like that, but we really hopefully will hear more and more about pollinator issues and see some government programs. You go to Europe and other parts of the world and there's much more awareness. I mean, in Europe in general, bees, honey, beeswax, and bee-related products are in very high demand, and there's a lot more sort of general awareness about these issues. I think we'll get there. You know, there's a lot of interest growing here in the United States about food and farming policy, but you know, it's sort of that the pollinators that are out there, I guess, somewhere doing their thing. They don't have any lobbyists or people out there rooting for them, I guess.
Are bees a canary in the coal mine?
The question was, are honeybees canary in the coal mine? And yeah, I guess so. I mean, they're definitely a barometer. You know, they're giving us an indicator of the amount of diversity that we have in our environment. It's a difficult question to ask because, you know, there's a lot of new farm chemicals that are being used, and there's a lot of different issues kind of about that. I mean, many of the chemicals now are safer, but the way they're applied is to apply to a plant and they're living in the plant, very small doses. And you know, the old types of chemicals was a surface application. There was no question it was deadly. These new ones, it's very difficult. You know, there's a lot of good data that suggests it is safe. I think what it comes down to is, you know, just like honey is different in different parts of the world, or you eat an apple that's grown in California and the same variety grows here and it tastes different. It depends, you know, the weather, the soil, the application, the situation. So, there's a lot of issues that are a concern. So I want to finish up here. That's sort of, I touched a little bit upon the honeybee life cycle and the beekeeping industry. The honey side of this, the food side of this, which interests me a lot. When I first got into beekeeping, I thought, you know, honey's honey, comes in a squeeze bottle, it tastes sweet. But I realized, you know, this honey tastes different here in the spring, different in the midsummer and the fall. And I realized, you know, there are different plants that bloom and produce different types of honey that taste differently. And that really is the basis of what we do at Ames Farm. We do sell like a bulk blended product that doesn't have an origin, maybe, or a plant or a time of the year. But our main business is the single source honey concept, the idea that you put one hive of bees in one location and one time period, and it's going to produce some very special honey. And anyone can do this, any beekeeper. You know, the equipment is set up to extract and process a lot of honey at once. But if you work with a 35-pound box that they make, you have a discrete sort of event. And when you buy one of our products, you'll see on there one of the 18 or 20 locations that we keep bees, the hive that came from, and then a letter, A, B, C, D. And those would be the different consecutive boxes that we put on during the season. And on the top of the label, I'll have the flower, if I knew what it was, or the time of the year. And all these taste different. And like the dandelion we collected this last year in 2012 was incredible, and the conditions were so unique. Remember last spring? I mean, that was a one-time maybe event that we might see in another 50 years, or maybe we, you know, maybe sooner, maybe not. So that's kind of the message I wanted to get across. When you buy honey for me or other beekeepers, realize, you know, that's an event. It's the soil and the plants and that whole season, the beekeeper, how they maintain their hives, how they took the honey off and handled it. It's a craft, just like, you know, this wonderful mead that we're having tonight. I've never tasted anything that good. So it's an art too. You know, you can give a hive of bees to someone and their interpretation of how those bees are going to work and how they manage the bees and pull the honey off. It's a very personal thing. So I wanted to leave you with that impression too, that honey is a very interesting and complex product. You can travel the world. Of course, in Greece, you know, a lot of interesting honey comes from there. Thyme grows wild all over the islands there. And the honey has a unique flavor. It's a more arid region than the soil and so on. And it's a very cool product to buy wherever you might travel. And it represents, you know, the type of land use there and the climate. There's just so much in that honey is what I'm trying to explain. And the different flavors of honey are useful too, you know, to serve with cheese, yogurt. I like eating honey just plain, you know, it has amazing flavor. You know, we eat sweet things, right? What's wrong with taking a spoonful of honey and enjoying, you know, that bouquet? And think about that day in the summer and what the weather might have been like and things like that. It's just not this one-dimensional sweetener that, you know, you might put on your cereal. So later, I guess we're going to enjoy more food, and I'm going to do a question and answer at the end, and then we'll have some samples up here. If you haven't tasted our honey before, we have some buckwheat here tonight. It's kind of the dark beer of honeys. It's a great one to serve with a goat cheese, put on plain yogurt. One of my favorites is the linden or basswood honey. It's flowery, a little bit minty, kind of limey. In parts of Europe, you would hear it referred to as lime honey or linden. I've won a number of blue ribbons on that. Back when I was still competing. There's a lot of effort that goes into entering state fair honey. I just don't have the time for it. But we have a few other unusual ones, too, like some savory spring honey that I collected on one of the last farms in Eden Prairie. I'm not sure what the flower is. I only got it at that place, and I only got like 50 pounds of it out of a, you know, 80,000-pound crop that we got. This is just such special honey, and I just want to share a little bit with you some of this different honey with you later, and we will have some available for purchase, but you can find our stuff at all the co-ops, Whole Foods, some of the lawn stores are carrying it, and not to forget the farmers markets. We're a big participant in the Mill City Farmers Market. I've been a longtime member of the Minneapolis market down there at Lindale. We're at Midtown a little bit during the summer. And yeah, I want to leave you too with this message of support other beekeepers. If you don't buy my honey, buy some local honey. I didn't have time to get into the issue of imported honey and things like that around the world. It's a little more technical, but yeah, buying local, you know, farm-produced products is really important for many different reasons. So, thanks.
This will be the last time we talk tonight. I'm going to talk a little bit about this final course, make a few announcements, and introduce a few people. You're all drinking, or most of you were getting the Greek coffee out. Greek coffee, if you don't know, is a little bit different than other coffees of the world, originating in Ethiopia and supposedly found when a goat herd noticed that the goats were getting frisky when they would eat these red berries, brought it to the Orthodox priest in the village and asked him, and the father brewed it, and it was so disgusting he threw it on the fire, at which he realized there was a fantastic aroma. He collected them again and reboiled them, and that's how coffee came about. So. In Greece, we take the coffee bean and we press it so it gets a little bit of the acid out, and then we lightly roast it, and we just boil it with sugar in the pulverized coffee. So there is no chocolate, but there is sugar added to this coffee. So, and you can or cannot drink the mud, that's up to you. You may have things to do tonight, I'm not sure. But in any case, so we're going to go with the second mead tonight. The mead is called Black Raspberry. It's very light and spritzery, and I hope you enjoy it. It'll be refreshing. And we're pairing that with a vegan, flourless chocolate. Oh, I lied. I'm sorry, it's not flourless. It is vegan, however. And we have a vegan dessert, flourless dessert. But it is... with sour cherries. Sour cherries, maybe you don't know, we have them in Minnesota. In fact, I have one sour cherry tree and one sweet cherry tree in my yard. And sour cherries have a wonderful, full, tart flavor. So it's with chocolate, and it's kind of a dense pot cake. And then we topped it with something that I really want you to understand what you're doing. It is, again, the sour cherries have been soaking in brandy for 2 months with some herbs. And I drained them last night, and I boiled them in honey. And so it has a whole different flavor, and that's going to be the little topping on that. And then we just drizzle with a little ganache and a little bit of Sunny's Organic Vanilla Ice Cream. So, you know, happy Valentine's. Thank you for sharing with us this month. We wanted to make it sweet for you. So thank you all for sharing. Thank you again, and look forward to talking with you afterwards.